Back together again, you and I chatting it up, wrapping up a busy week, Friday, May 2nd, 2025 on Connecticut Today. I highlighted a proposal to give private sector striking workers across Connecticut access to unemployment funds after 14 days on a picket line. University of New Haven economics professor John Rosen talked about the state of the economy, tariffs, and the latest U.S. job numbers. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso dropped by with his weekly wrap-up, including a spotlight on parking issues in cities like Bridgeport. CBS News correspondent Aaron Navarro joined us with the latest from the White House. And we also took some time to chat with Boston Globe columnist Chad Finn. He's the author of the Boston Globe story of the Celtics, 1946 to the present, the inside stories and the claim reporting on the NBA's banner franchise. All right, so let me say right up front, I have never been active in a strike. I've never been in a situation where I have been told by a labor union, a union leader, a union collective bargaining unit that, hey, we're walking out Monday morning at 6 a.m. or we're walking out at 10 a.m. Be ready to grab a sign and join us on the picket line. So let me say right up front, I have never done that. Let me also add that I fully support the notion of collective bargaining. I am very much a proponent of unions, especially in the private sector. Now, we can discuss about the propensity and the necessity of unions for cities and towns and federal employees and state employees, because all too often taxpayers on every level have no recourse but to get treated like an ATM. Cha-ching. You know, there's automatic binding arbitration now in most spots for municipal unions and state unions, so that's a different story. You know my feelings on that. Now, having said that, back to the back to the situation of a private company, ABC Widgets, let's say, and the fine unionized workers of a local 123 of the United Amalgamated Widget Makers of America. And let's say that at ABC Widgets, everything which is usually copacetic and it is, tea and crumpets and kumbaya, things get nasty, and the local members of the United Widget Makers and Widget Engineers of America, they want to go on strike. Okay, they have every right to do that, okay? They have every single right to do that. I am 100% in favor. I am 100% in favor their ability to go on strike. 100% in favor of that. But if Democrats at the General Assembly in the State House and State Senate get their way, they want to put their thumb on the scale. What am I talking about? Well, there's a new caucus that has just formed. It is called the Blue Collar Caucus in the House and Senate up there in Hartford. Whatever that means, the Blue Collar Caucus. Whenever you see blue collar on anything, you automatically, in this state, can come to the realization of, this is going to be put the screws to business. And it is. Now, two state representatives are co-chairing this. Democrat Kara Rochelle of Ansonia and Democrat Rebecca Martinez of Plainville. And I guess they held a news availability yesterday. And the group's priorities, expanding job training, reinforcing wage laws, ensuring access to affordable health care, yada, yada, yada. Well, you scroll down in this story here, and a key focus, apparently, of this group is Senate Bill 8. The name of the bill is, now you got to see how they do this. The name of the bill is an act concerning protections for workers and enhancements to workers' rights. Ooh, gets me all a quiver. Makes my loins move. And then you actually break down what the bill is about. The bill would provide unemployment insurance benefits to striking workers. That's right. So if the United Widget Workers of America went on strike at ABC Widgets located here in Connecticut, the widget capital of the world, then for some reason, a fund that's designed to compensate people, and Lord knows I've been on unemployment before, designed to compensate people if they were by no means of their own disconnected from their jobs, is now, if I guess you believe they're calling themselves the Blue Collar Caucus. They want, and it says right here, I'm not making it up, a key focus is Senate Bill 8, a bill that would provide unemployment insurance benefits to striking workers. Are you kidding me? Seriously. Seriously, we're going to pay unemployment benefits, which are designed by statutes to be paid to somebody who gets laid off or fired through no fault of their own. That's what you and I pay unemployment benefits for. But now, and again, you wonder why nobody ever sets up big new businesses in this state. You wonder why Connecticut is on almost every ranking. Wall Street Journal, Fox Business, CNBC, CBS Market Watch. Cost of doing business in Connecticut is prohibitive. Why? Because we do things like this. Listen, I'm not against any union going on strike if they believe they're getting the Shaftarino there. Nothing wrong with that at all. But we're going to start paying workers who decided of their own volition to go on strike? Really? You okay with that? I'm not. Nothing against unions, nothing against collective bargaining, but really, we're now gonna have companies all over the state looking at us, laughing even harder all over the country here. Seriously, you tell me, am I nuts here or not? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. It's our question of the day today, leading us off on Facebook as well. Should striking private sector workers in Connecticut be eligible to collect unemployment compensation? If they went on strike of their own volition, not that they were fired, not that the company went out of business, not that there were mass layoffs, really? Are you okay with the state putting its thumb on the scale against business owners? So it's a pretty simple question we begin with as we wrap up this busy week on this Friday, the 2nd of May 2025. Should striking private sector workers in Connecticut. Now, they went on strike, okay? So they decided to walk out. It happens a lot. Maybe not here in Connecticut. I think there are one or two active strikes going on here in Connecticut. By the way, my days when I was a street reporter covering picket lines, nothing better. Nothing, let me tell you something, nothing better. Nothing better than covering angry striking workers on picket lines, who are laughing with you and joking with you at 1 minute, and then when the scabs come in, oh, man, I'm like, wow, I haven't heard that term in a while. Woo, baby! But seriously, should a serious question here, because there is a new caucus up in Hartford there, a group of legislators getting together. This is called the Blue Collar Caucus, and they say they want to support the working class in Connecticut, whatever that means. Last time I looked, everybody who has a job works, but I digress. So apparently, and the caucus is headed by two Democratic state reps, Kara Rochelle of Ansonia and Rebecca Martinez of Plainville. And one of the things, according to this story in the Connecticut News Junkie, that they are particularly enthralled with is a bill called an act concerning protections for workers and enhancements to workers' rights. Okay, so you hear that and you say, oh, protection for workers. We don't want workers to get maimed on the job. We don't want worker safety. But the breakdown of this is actually that the bill would provide unemployment insurance to striking workers. Now, I don't think it would kick in right away. I think there would be a 2 or 3 week wait. But even if that is 2 or 3 weeks, to me, and this is why I don't like this, after 2 weeks or whatever, it seems to be, and am I wrong? Do you think I'm being a jerk here? Rhetorical question, Paul. Of course you are. No. 203-333-9422. If this bill was passed, and it probably could be passed, knowing the gaps that the Democrats have in Hartford, is this putting the thumb on the scale, as they say, weighting, W-E-I-G-H-T-I-N-G, weighting down ostensibly a private dispute between a private company and unionized workers in favor of those workers? Should this, because this is what essentially this bill would do, if you think about it. It would take money, right? Now think about this. The state mandates that a certain percentage of our check, I don't know what the percentage is offhand, I forgot, I used to know, but the state of Connecticut mandates that X percentage of your check, 2, 3%, whatever it is, goes to the unemployment compensation fund. Okay, I don't, listen, I've been on unemployment a few times, but not because I went on strike. It's because I was laid off or a station was sold or whatever. Happens in this business, happens in the entertainment field all the time. Did I use the unemployment? You're damn well sure I did. Every cent I legally could, I used. I hated being on it. I wasn't on it for too long. I used it to supplement my bill paying for a few months, and bingo, luckily I landed on my feet and here we are. But the bottom line is, and strip away all this workers' rights and protections for workers, are you in favor of having the state get in the middle of a private labor dispute? And I know that people are going to say, well, the employer always has the advantage. Well, yeah, that's because they're the employer. I know you may think it sucks, but I have an idea. Here you go. In America, since the first job, whatever that was, a carpenter or a blacksmith or whatever, when the Pilgrims got here or they settled Jamestown, whatever that was, or Plymouth, the first time you had such a relationship of an employer and employee, the employer, to some way, shape, or form, has always had the advantage. That's just the way it is. And there are a lot of really good employers out there. There are some decent employers. There are some okay employers. And then there are some really lousy, rotten employers out there. We get it. We understand it. That's not the issue. The issue isn't whether or not one side is right or one side is wrong in a dispute. That's not the issue here. The issue is, why does this, well, we know why. Because this curries votes with unions and blue-collar workers, which, by the way, Donald Trump stole from Democrats on a national basis. That's another reason this is getting pushed now. Because, laugh at him or not, Trump went out there and told all largely blue-collar individuals, white males, non-college-educated males, say, hey, what's the Democratic Party done for you over the past 15, 20, 30, 40 years? Now, you can debate that. That's the second part of the equation here. But what do you think about this? I'm a solid no on this. Absolutely. Absolutely. No. No, no, no. And it's not because I love employers. It's not because I'm siding against workers. It's fundamentally wrong for any government, any state, any nation, any town, any county. It is fundamentally wrong. I think, anyway, you can disagree with me at 333-9422, 333-WICC. I just think it's fundamentally wrong for a government to come in and say, well, these people who went on strike of their own volition, they should get some money from a fund that was intended for people who had no control over what happened to them. Agree or not, talk or text 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. It's a simple question. Should striking workers after a couple of weeks be able to collect unemployment from the state. Now, we apparently had some pretty good, not too bad, all right, numbers for the economy, for unemployment, or employment, over the past few days. To discuss those with us, return visit from University of New Haven economics professor John Rosen to talk about what we've heard over today in the past few days. Hey, John, it's Paul here on WICC. Good to have you back. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for having me. How are you?
Good, good, John. I it sounds like you're on a speaker there. If you can move up a little closer, that'd be great. So
I'm actually on my phone, so I don't know what else I can do.
No, that's much better. No, you're better right now. So what are we looking at here? I guess give us a read on the – before we get to the other stuff, before we get to that, give us a read on the employment numbers here. What do you think?
Well, the employment numbers were slightly better than economists were predicting, and certainly – I'll try to stay out of politics. It was certainly better than Trump's critics were predicting, right? Which is significant for the following reason. Mm-hmm. It's probably the first hard measure of something that happened entirely after the economic moves and Trump's tariffs and so forth of the first quarter. In other words, a lot of stuff measures the whole quarter. This one measures just the month of April.
Got it.
And it was pretty good, meaning we don't have enormous layoffs except in the federal government. Mm-hmm. And in point of fact, the unemployment rate is precisely where it was last month. I suppose one way to look at that is it's still awfully early for employers to adjust to the turmoil coming out of Washington. Mm. So I get to say what gives economists a bad name. Well, we'll have to wait and see another couple months.
Yeah.
Well, so unfortunately, that's probably the right answer.
Yeah. So, John, does it sound like then they're not running around like crazy? This isn't a Chicken Little thing. I mean, they're concerned. I get it. But are they just pumping the brakes a little bit here on the hysteria that's out there?
Well, this certainly should, and at least based on the little amount of time I've been watching the news channels on TV, that's mm-hmm. pretty much what is going on. Everybody is pretty much saying some version of what I just said to you. Well, we got to wait and see. You can't take 1 month and declare either victory or defeat or whatever word you're looking for. And that's probably true. I would say that the best news in today's report mm-hmm. is what we call the participation rate mm-hmm. went up. And I won't get into all the technical details on that, but it basically means that more people have come back into the job market. In other words, people that had given up looking for a job a year ago or take an early retirement or something, more of them are jumping back into the job market, and that typically means they expect to get a job. They see opportunity out there, and that's usually a positive.
Professor John Rosen joining us, Pompeia School of Business, University of New Haven. Tariffs. And you're laughing before the question. No, I get it. I understand it, John. I've talked to a lot of people on tariffs. Again, they say the wait and see thing. But again, we're so early into this. Do we really know if and what effect these are having? Or are some of these tariffs, John, not even in effect yet? How is this all running?
Well, it is true that nearly all of them are not in effect yet. He announced a pause about whatever that was, three weeks ago or
mm-hmm.
something.
Yeah.
Trump announced a 90-day pause, which I think a labor negotiator would call a cooling off period.
Yeah.
And at least the promise that the Trump administration is giving us is that over these 90 days, they will be negotiating with virtually every country in hopes that we can all come to an agreement and we won't have to put the tariffs out there. We'll all still be friends and do business together. But the tariff regime will be more fair. Trump's word, not mine. We'll talk about that later if you want. But anyway, it is too early, and it's by design too early. Trump announced them. Then a week or two later, he said 90-day pause. So it really is too early. We don't know what's going to happen until after the pause.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about that, John. In the couple of minutes we have left here, let's touch on a few things, including fair tariffs. I mean, you know, John, with all due respect to the wonderful people of this country, they see numbers, and heck, I see these numbers, right? And I'm not nearly as updated on you on this. And I say, well, okay, that's a number, but I have no idea whether that's fair or not, or what it applies to. So, what in a sense, John, is a fair tariff?
So, in a perfect world, there would be no tariffs at all.
Yeah.
And by the way, I would venture to guess you and everybody else on Earth agrees with that, even though you haven't actually thought about it. Imagine if you had to pay a tax on bread that was made with wheat from Kansas, and a car that was built in Michigan, and a movie that was made in California, right? Literally, the cost of everything would be much higher, and the amount of commerce would be much lower. And it essentially is the reason the United States is rich.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big free trade area. So out there, outside our borders, it gets messy.
Yeah.
Countries try to put tariffs on to protect their home industries. And in general, it has been the United States's position ever since World War II that we will allow other countries to do more of that to us than we do to them.
Yep.
In the interest of global prosperity and building alliances. And whether or not that's fair, that's too loaded a word. That's a debate that goes on forever.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair that we pay more taxes on a BMW than the Germans do on a Ford?
Sure.
Probably not. On the other hand, is it fair that therefore the Germans are on our side staring at Russia, not on Russia's side staring at us?
Exactly.
And that's literally the deal we've made since World War II.
Yeah. 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 John, thanks. Appreciate it. Yeah, just wait and see. Like I always say, take a breath, have a milkshake, pump the brakes. Professor John Rosen, University of New Haven at the Pompeia School of Business. John, thanks. Good to talk with you. We'll chat down the road. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. You see, even the academics agree with me. Here's a guy who always brings great stuff. Former Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso joins us. Mr. Caruso, sir, how might you be today?
I'm doing well. Good evening, Paul, and I hope you're getting ready for the weekend.
Oh, I am, Chris. Let me tell you, it'll be nonstop action at my place. Yeah, believe me, Chris, sleep is a food group for me on the weekend.
Oh, I understand it. I really do.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about three things.
Sure.
Today,
go right ahead.
One is House Bill 7061, and your listeners should also hear House Bill 5002.
Okay.
House Bill 7061, the first one, deals with something that's happening across the country and even internationally, mm-hmm. where the legislature in Connecticut is mandating that for those commissions that don't have parking requirements for development, they're not able to require it. So, for example, in Bridgeport on East Main Street, the old Astor Theater has remained pretty vacant. The theater burnt down years ago, and the lot's been pretty vacant.
Mm-hmm.
So developers come in and building a 6-story building, 74 apartment units, with no on-site parking.
With nowhere to park.
Yeah, you got it. So what happens is now people have to park on the streets.
Yeah.
They apparently have something 2 blocks away, but it wouldn't even accommodate the number of those units. And in today's world, you don't get by with one car anymore.
No.
So you have more than one. But their argument is that transit, that's why people should be leaving their homes and getting on buses and trains. And not every community is designed that way, in particular New England. You know, we're not a New York City where mass transportation is the way to go. Owning cars isn't encouraged. We're not a Los Angeles. We're not Pittsburgh or Portland, Oregon, mm-hmm. places like that. So this is a move to increase affordable housing, which I'm not opposed to affordable housing, but frankly, what's been building in Bridgeport is not affordable. The units are going from anywhere from 1,700 to 2,200, 2,300.
Yeah.
So they're not affordable. But anyway, people should be aware of it. They should call their legislators and tell them to oppose the bill. And 7061 may be melded into 5002 in order to make it more acceptable, because the bill 5002 deals with the homeless. So it's harder for a legislature to vote against the homeless. So they may put it in that bill. So I would encourage everyone out there who has a zoning commission or who has worked in neighborhood opposition or spoken in favor of it to call their legislators, telling them to oppose 7061 and anything that would eliminate parking requirements, because it's already happening in Bridgeport and it's going to happen in other towns as well. So it's something that people need to be aware of. If there are no parking requirements, what you're doing is tying the hands of your local zoning boards, which could be devastating to communities. So, again, get on the phone, email, text your representatives in the state legislature, House and Senate, to let them know oppose House Bill 7061 and anything that takes that language and puts it into another bill.
Sure. So those are the two bills. Now you wanted to talk, I guess, about some cuts of the Bridgeport schools, Chris.
Yeah, I think you've probably read recently they're cutting, or I should say laying off 20 teachers. I think it's somewhere like 40 paraprofessionals, social workers. All the librarians are going to be removed, assistant principals. It's really going to be devastating for a system that's already under so much pressure, and teachers that are under so much pressure as it is with a lot of the social issues that come into the schools. This is going to make it, you know, intolerable, frankly. And that's why, again, the legislature is looking at the educational cost sharing formula, and they're looking to amend it, make changes to it, so that we look, rather than at some of the issues, we look at the level of poverty within a community, how many people are low income, and also the number of languages spoken in a city could also go to that. So, again, all legislators, all of your callers should call again to the legislature and encourage that they pass the modifications to the education cost sharing. Interestingly enough, Bridgeport is not alone in these cuts.
Yeah.
Norwalk has experience with other communities. Even some of the down county communities have been experiencing it. And, of course, the larger cities. If this legislation passes, Bridgeport would receive roughly $57 million, which would bring those teachers back. But more than that, it would add other resources to the system, and it would be a fairer process. Across the board, small towns and large cities would see increases under a revised educational cost-sharing formula. So, again, make your call. Tell them to approve the modifications to that legislation. And it would be better for all of us. You're seeing some towns having to raise local property taxes in order to fill the void between the state and the public school systems in their towns.
Chris, a couple things here before we wrap up. Do we know whether or not this forensic audit is actually going on of the school system? Because that's great, the stuff you raised, but I think one of the burning questions that you and I have talked about, Chris, is where did this mountain of red ink come from? Is that audit going on? Have you heard anything on that or not?
Well, I think it's being put together now. It hasn't started.
Okay.
But I think the audit would be very helpful. So if the city of Bridgeport receives more funding for education, the forensic audit is going to show where the weaknesses are in the system, you know, where we're overfunding, maybe where we're underfunding. And I think that's going to be helpful. But without the additional funding, we're going to go nowhere. It's only going to get worse. And when people move into cities, they look at education as one of the reasons for the move. That's why some of the suburban towns do so much better than the cities, where their school systems are different in the sense that more kids are being educated, they're reaching the minimum levels that they need, and in some cases exceeding it. So when they look online, a buyer of a house or moving in, they look at a suburban town and say, gee, the school system is really working well. And part of that is that in cities there's a concentration of poverty, low-income
yeah.
families, that the state has to make up the gap. In Bridgeport, frankly, we have been underfunding the city share for years.
Mm.
I've spoken at public hearings. Last year, I think they gave them $2 million. This year, they're talking $3
million. Mm-hmm.
But the state requires minimum requirements that every municipality has to meet in order to receive the state funding. In Bridgeport and in a lot of communities across the state, they never reach the minimum, partly because of so many other demands on those systems of property tax and so forth. But the city needs to step up, too. And I encourage the mayor and the city council in this budget this year to add more funding.
And finally, Chris, on the issue that you talked about earlier with parking and development, you know, these developments that we see in places like Bridgeport and Hartford and my hometown, New Haven, it's great when you see new developments there and new repurposed buildings and nice, spiffy businesses. But, man, Chris, I got to tell you, and I understand the developers want to make money, but even with the affordable housing units that are set aside, some of these rents are just, and again, I don't know what the answer is, but some of these rents are just, they're nice if you can afford them, but a lot of people, especially in the core parts of these cities, they're unaffordable. I don't know what you do about that.
Well, I think there's a number of things. First of all, a city shouldn't rely on just affordable housing. It has to have commercial development, small business development. And what happens in particular is with communities across the state, they really have no strategic plan on how they want to build their cities.
You've talked about that. I remember you've talked about this a lot. Yeah.
So when you look at a city like Bridgeport, if there's no plan in place, then you take the first developer that comes along. And the developer sees an empty lot, I'm going to build affordable housing because affordable housing is cheaper to build, frankly, than commercial development, right? You know, look at the market in Bridgeport. How many single-family homes have we seen built? How many condominiums have been built? And the numbers are very low. It's mainly going toward affordable housing. But what we've seen in Bridgeport, because the lack of commercial development, our grand list has decreased, which means an increase in our property taxes. So they both work hand in hand. And, you know, I think, interesting enough, is going to be the state budget, which you've seen the Republicans have put out their proposal, the Democrats have out there, and now the dance of the tango begins. And I think they'll get somewhere in the middle. I know the governor's holding fast to the guardrails and a few others, and I think that's positive. But I also think there's got to be some attention to areas that the federal budget's going to cut and will we be able to carry, such as Medicaid. You know, Medicaid is in large part helping senior citizens in nursing facilities, right?
Yeah.
And poorer people who can't afford the doctor visits or things like that. So we've got to look at that impact. But overall, at least the budget negotiations, I think, have begun in earnest, and we'll see where it all ends up.
All right. Chris Caruso. Chris, great segment there. Thank you. Have a happy weekend. We'll talk next week, sir. Thanks.
You too, Paul.
All right, Chris. Thank you. Joining us right now, though, from the White House, one of our folks down in D.C., CBS reporter Aaron Navarro, who I'm sure is subsisting on some sort of caffeine, as those folks do. Aaron, how are you, man? What's going on?
Paul, good to be with you. Happy Friday. I've had my caffeine bill today.
Is there like a White House or a Capitol? I mean, how many coffee stations are there? I mean, there can't be just one.
At least two. I've seen at least two.
Okay.
Around, and of course, at the CBS Bureau, we have a couple.
Very nice. Hey, our junior U.S. Senator here in Connecticut, Chris Murphy, you've probably seen him. He's pretty much carpet bombing the administration here, Aaron, on this Ukrainian minerals deal. He came on, you know, I used some audio from him the other day. He says it's absolute garbage. It's not worth the paper it's written on. Other people are saying, hey, not bad. How is the White House spinning this, and what are they saying to the critics on this Ukraine minerals deal?
You know, certainly a lot of details we are waiting to see, but here's what we know so far. This deal is called the United States-Ukraine Reinvestment Fund, and basically the U.S. Would have, through this fund, through this agreement, would have access to Ukrainian minerals, rare earth minerals, as they're known, which can be used for cell phones, smartphones, computers, weapons. And they would have a hand in any potential revenue from that. In return, Ukraine could get potential financial and military assistance from the U.S., which President Trump has already kind of been dangling in front of them. And how the White House has spun this is this is something that President Trump has wanted for a while. He wanted President Zelensky of Ukraine to sign it a couple months ago in what eventually became that iconic turbulent Oval Office meeting between the two of them and Vice President Vance. And he sees, you know, access to these minerals, the potential economic benefit as a sort of payback for aid given by the U.S. during President Biden's term to Ukraine during their war with Russia. Though it's important to note, at least from what we've heard from Ukrainian officials, this agreement focuses on future U.S. military assistance. Potentially, it's not necessarily paying back for what they've given already.
And finally, Aaron, I mean, this is a situation where, you know, in this whole thing, I guess part of the bet here is that if there are Americans working in or around these facilities, they're betting that Vladimir Putin won't attack them, right? Isn't that part of it?
That's potentially part of it, though. Again, some of the details like that, we're waiting to see. We kind of just know the top lines in terms of, you know, the revenues, the split of that. Ukraine itself still maintains full ownership and control of the rare earth mineral resources. They determine what and where minerals can be extracted. But certainly could see the U.S. Playing up their role, perhaps, in this agreement to get what they can in terms of these mineral funds. And then just real quickly, the access to these minerals comes at a point where you're already seeing the tariffs on China impact electronics coming to the U.S. You could see the argument from the White House that having access to these minerals helps the U.S. with their own technology.
All right, Aaron, thank you as always. Aaron Navarro, CBS News. Aaron, take care. Have a good weekend, man. Take care.
You too.
All right, there you go. Great to have you, Chad. What goes into putting a book like this together? It's a storied franchise, one of the great sports franchises, not just in the U.S., but all over the world. I think that's fair to say. What goes into putting together something like this?
Fortunately, with this book, I had some experience structuring it because we'd done the Red Sox one, as you mentioned, in 2023. And the big thing that hangs over your head, particularly with a storied organization like the Celtics, is you just don't want to miss anything. I can't tell you how many times I went back through the book and counted up the stories on the championships, their 18 titles, just to make sure I didn't accidentally leave one out because there were so many that it didn't become redundant, but it was familiar, especially through the 60s. But just in terms of structuring the book, really, you just start with a list of everything you need. Use all your resources to create kind of a timeline of the history. And then you go through the Globe archives and go about finding the stories that correspond with those. And we did not miss a single story that was relevant in Boston history. The Globe was there to cover every little piece of Celtics lore.
I was a BU guy, class of 83, Chad, so I was there right at the outset of the Larry Bird era, and I think it's fitting that on the cover of this, as we look at it here, you've got Larry Bird there facing off against two of the Lakers greats, and boy, those series, Chad, the hard-fought series. You know, I look at those series back then and how they fought, and look at the NBA today, and I say, wow, what a difference. I mean, just having Bird on the cover is amazing. Was that a tough choice to put Larry on the cover with all the greats the Celtics have had?
It was, because my first thought was Bill Russell. I mean, 11 championships, 13 years, first black coach in NBA history. So much historical impact and the greatest winner in American team sports. But you need certain things for a cover. A color photograph would be nice.
Yeah.
And one that kind of expands so that it looks good on a cover. It doesn't become pixelated or something like that. And we had a tougher time finding that. We had some great photographs that are in the book of Bill Russell, but it would have been challenging to use them as cover photos for a couple of reasons. With Larry and the photo that we chose, it just felt like it fit in a lot of ways. I think the heyday for a lot of people that will pick up the book and their fondest memories are of those 80s Celtics that you mentioned. It's playing against the Lakers, their greatest rival. It's at the old Boston Garden, which stirs those sentimental memories. It's just a lot working in favor of the photo we ultimately chose.
The Celtics, as you mentioned, 18 titles, edging out the Lakers. And, you know, Chad, I've always thought that if you're the NBA, it's the Celtics and the Lakers. And I'm talking about this from a business point of view, from a league point of view. I know the Knicks have two titles, and Golden State's had a nice run, and, of course, the Bulls years with Michael Jordan. But am I crazy to say that the NBA has more relevance when the Celtics are good? Can you call the Celtics the marquee franchise of pro basketball in the U.S.?
You can call them the singular marquee franchise now because they got their 18th banner last year, which last season was put someone ahead of the Lakers. So there's no more tie there at least for now. But they are the pillars of the league, those two franchises. Going back to the 60s with the rivalry with Russell and Wilt Chamberlain and Jerry West and Havlicek, and that's where this enduring rivalry developed. And then the pinnacle of it was the 80s with Bird against Magic and East Coast, West Coast, and Lakers flashy Hollywood style, and the Celtics being flashy in their own way, but a little bit more methodical. And it came at a time when television was taking off largely because Magic and Bird elevated basketball and the NBA and the consciousness of fans with the unselfish way that they played and brought the league to an entirely new level. So it is it's an incredible rival. Knicks fans will tell you that they belong in that conversation, but they haven't won a title since early
70s. No, Chad, I'm a Knicks fan. We don't belong there, okay? we don't belong in the neighborhood, Chad, okay? The Celtics also, through the history that you've chronicled in this book, I don't know if there's been a more flamboyant, more in-your-face, more relevant front office guy and coach and mentor than Red Auerbach.
Yeah, flamboyant's a great word for it. He told you how he felt, and he told you in colorful language. And he's probably the most successful executive in American team sports, especially for the long run that he had, which is from the early 50s until Rick Pitino shoved him aside in the mid-90s when he came and took his president's title away from him in his ill-fated and brief tenure here. But Red let you know where he stood on things and what he thought of you. And as great as he was, you need a little bit of luck, too. He didn't want Bob Cousy back in the early 50s. Cousy was a superstar at Holy Cross. Everybody loved him. College basketball was huge at that point in time. And he thought he was too small for the NBA and made it clear he didn't want the local yokel on the team. Got him sort of against his will in a dispersal draft. And, of course, Cousy becomes the league's first great superstar. So Red got a few breaks along the way, too.
Yeah, and finally, Chad, the thing I like about this book, and I have books in my collection sort of like this. I love reading the sports writing from a great newspaper like The Globe or other books, The Times, whatever, Washington Post. But I think it's great you're doing this because if only to see how sports writing has also evolved over the years under the tutelage of great writers and covering a singular franchise like the Celtics.
Yeah, it really is interesting. It was fascinating with the Red Sox book that we did, too, because it goes back to 1901. And one of the real pleasant surprises was that the writing was still pretty readable from the 1903 World Series and stuff like that. With the Celtics coming around 1946, it goes from being pretty straightforward reporting, not a lot of bells and whistles in the writing, to into the 60s, where you get a little bit more stylistic approach from some of the writers. The Bob Sales, who eventually became the sports editor at the Herald, was one of the first at the Globe that wrote with some color. And then when Lee Montville and Barb Ryan and writers like that came around in the late 60s, that's when the game changed.
The Boston Globe story of the Celtics 1946 to the present, the inside stories and acclaimed reporting on the NBA's banner franchise, authored and put together by Chad Finn. Hey, Chad, thanks. It's been great. Good luck with the book, and we'll chat down the road. Thanks.
Hey, thank you. Great talking to you, Paul.